Welcome back to the Watson Weekly. There is a lot of noise in the agency landscape right now. You have people claiming AI is going to make agencies infinitely profitable. And you have private equity rolling up firms left and right. You have brands who are paralyzed, wondering if they need to rip out their entire tech stack just to stay relevant. Today, I'm trying to cut through that noise with Mark Rubin. If you've been in the ecosystem for a while, you know Mark. He was involved in Precision Design Studios, was a co-owner at Moku Collective, and he's seen the PE or private equity cycle up close. Now, he's leading up Kasama. We talk about why the AI gold rush might actually be a trap for agencies, and we dig into his controversial take on why, despite what most salespeople will tell you, you probably shouldn't re-platform this year. Let's get into it. It's great to be having this conversation, Mark. You've been in the trenches of e-commerce longer than most people, you know, from early days at Lions, helping build PDS. Tell us, how did you get from being an early employee back in the day to kind of running the show at Kasama today?
Yeah. So also, thanks for having me on, Rick. Huge fan and super excited to get to do this after all the years we've known each other. So my background was a .NET and Java developer. And so I was doing that. I had moved to Chicago. I was doing some consulting for a group called Lions Consulting. Before that, I dabbled in e-commerce. I did some Yahoo store work where I met a future star in the Salesforce world named Steve Holsinger. I had my own like consulting firm doing $500 websites for people. But Lions had me as a .NET developer, and they got a contract to build a website on this new technology called Demandware. And they asked me if I would learn it. And I went to monster.com and to dice.com and searched for Demandware jobs. And there were two in the country. There was one at Lions and there was one at Demandware in Boston. And there's thousands of .NET and Java jobs. And so I went to Rich and I was like, why would I do this? And he said, I'll pay you $10 an hour more. And I was like, when do I start?
Right. That seems like a good idea.
Yeah. And so it was a difficult platform at the time. The documentation was lacking, the ability to debug was lacking, but something just worked. And I became really good at it. And I got a bit of attention. One of the tech leaders there was forming a new agency called PDS and invited me to be one of the first employees. I joined, started speaking at conferences, getting a name out there, and ended up having my name written into a contract for one of the biggest ever at the time, like Demandware builds. And so that really kind of put me on the map. So as we're growing, one of the fellow employees, Ben, said that he was going to start another agency and asked if I would join. And I did. And I saw a lot of lessons, both good and bad, from the time at Lions and at PDS, and thought we could do it better at a new agency called Moku Collective. And we did a lot of things better, and we also made a ton of the same mistakes. You know, things that you don't realize that as an agency owner, like oftentimes, like, yeah, like your employees see you make a mistake, but what they don't realize is that was the least bad option. There were many other bad options out there. And so did that. We were super lucky. Okay. When Salesforce bought Demandware, there was a feeding frenzy of partners, and we found an agency that matched our company culture and matched our vibes or spirit. Mm-hmm. And so we eventually sold. Spent some time in the wilderness working on the client side as VP of engineering at a company called FSA Store. Always knew I would start or something again, but I both wanted to honor my non-compete and also like I'd been a seller forever. I'd never been an operator, never been like client side. And I think that time in the wilderness has made me a better consultant now. And I try to pass that knowledge on to the people.
Yeah. So funny you describe going client side as being in the wilderness.
Well, I mean, like for a guy that had been doing agency work and consulting for so long. Yeah.
Right. That's hilarious. And so you fast forwarded a little bit through the journey inside of PE. Moku was acquired and then acquired, I don't know how many times over. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So we were part of a group called DEG, an awesome group. They had been running for 20 years. They were just like us, just more successful. And they bought a smaller Demandware shop a year or two earlier. And I don't know the full details. This is all speculation, but probably their bankers said like you need to have more of a commerce offering before you can sell. And so we sold, or like to them, knowing full well that they didn't say it, but they were likely going to sell in the next year or two once they had the more well-rounded offering. And so they bought, or like they were sold to Dentsu, who is a big holding company. And when you buy a smaller company, they say, okay, you company, you're going to be managed under an Isobar, or you'll be managed under a Merkle. And so when I was there, we were managed by Isobar, and then later Merkle.
You see these acquisitions sort of happening all the time. And how do you view it now as a founder? Are you trying to build things a different way? There's definitely a different way of building a company to be sold versus to kind of build over time.
Yeah, like there's a lot to kind of unpack there, right? When we sold, we had seen a number of our friends sell earlier, and what happened inevitably was key leaders would leave, maybe quality would drop off, and we had a goal to be the least messy integration of all time, and even with that goal, it still was. I rarely seen a big investment acquisitions not turn messy after the checks had cleared. So it's hard. I mean, right? I mean, because there's competing interests. The owners maybe now have more wealth than they've had before. And as builders, you want to build something new. So it's difficult.
Ultimately, what are some of the competing forces that come in after you get sold?
Or do you remember like the end of your last question first, though? So I'll answer that. You said building a company to sell versus building another. There's nothing wrong with building a company to sell, or like as long as you're doing it. We are building a company to be proud of. And a natural byproduct of that is if you're building a successful company, people will come. But that's not our intention. My father-in-law said something at our wedding, basically said like, your goal as a parent is to raise someone that someone wanted take from you. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not building because I want to be sold, but I am building something that I want to be proud of.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. And I think the fact that the PE world is so difficult makes you want to protect what you have at times, I'm sure.
Yeah, it does. I mean, like you can see, right, you know, for those not in the space, right, like if you see someone takes an investment or they're buying other companies, like the clock is ticking. Yeah, like it's rare. It's rare if they're not in like the 1,000+ employee range that there's not some other sort of work event happening. So once the PE comes in, you are on that clock. And whether it's, whether it's a roll-up, whether it's something else, like you're on the clock, like you're ticking. People have timers, people have milestones that they have to hit. And so maybe when you're just an owner, you can say, all right, I'll eat that cost for client satisfaction. But now if you eat that cost, that means that you may not get your next mile or like you might not get your next payment milestone. And so you alienate either your employees or your customers, and it just turns into a vicious cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think another thing that seems to be hitting the agency world right now, and I think this is a good transition point, is clearly AI. You were mentioning before the call that you had a brand meant say to you that this should be the golden age of agencies.
Yeah.
And didn't seem to hit you the right way. Can you talk about that?
No. Like I was talking to this awesome woman at the Lead Summit earlier last year in New York, and she said it was a golden age. And I was like, no, it's like terrifying right now. Because, like agencies, we either work, get paid by the hour, or you work on a fixed bid, and the fixed bid you have to have trust in your process and your IP to get things going. And so maybe a year or two ago, it was like that golden age where you could sneak it. But I mean, like most of our clients are using AI tools every day. It's making their lives faster. And when we started putting AI like provisions into our MSAs several years ago, we got rejections by most of the legal teams saying there's no way. And now if we don't put it in, like we're not going to get hired.
I think that's an important point to realize before things have flipped so quickly.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
What are they expecting now that they didn't want before?
They want less waste, less churn. I mean, because a lot of the things that you do are tedious work, right? Mm. Like we talk to people when we're trying to maybe quote like a new implementation, and like we'll say something like, this isn't hard, but it takes time. Right. You know, like you think about trying to make like the My Account section of a platform work. Yeah, like all the screens across, like all the different viewpoints, it just takes a lot of time to get going. It's not hard, And so with AI tools, like, you can help accelerate that, or you can use it to help these startups.
Yeah.
So if there's less billable work for me, that means that I need more IP. I need more salespeople. I need more churn. And so some agencies, and like, we're not there yet, are making bets with clients saying that we want to have our fees be like results based as opposed to like, yeah, deliverables or time and materials based. And I think if you can do it right and you find a client that's really willing to partner with you on it, it can be mutually successful.
Yeah. Yeah. I had this discussion with Travis Hess, the CEO of Commerce, recently, and we were talking about the different models, and you're talking about kind of the results performance-based model. Yeah. Is it a trap for agencies? I mean, how much do you really have control over performance of the brand that you're working on?
Oh yeah. Yeah. If it's something like they're already up and running and you're doing a checkout optimization or page speed improvement, absolutely. But things like working on the assortment, working on maybe search, other tools like that, other AI pieces, it's not as guaranteed. If you go through and you log all the things that you've done, you get your own IP, like you get, you know, like a good repeatable process, then there's a lower risk, but it's never risk-free.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, you were in this strange situation where, you know, your brand partner, like, who was telling you this, I guess they knew and then they didn't know. I mean, you could do less because AI is there, but because clients know that too, they expect that there's no fat at all anywhere in a project.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting now, like when we get someone who's maybe a junior or mid-level developer, we have mandated AI tools on all projects that clients allow it for years, for like code assist, for language, and then for arc improvement of your general process. Mm-hmm. And what we see a lot now is maybe a lack of trust, like how much of this code was delivered from your brain versus AI. And so we've had to do sessions where we code with our clients to show that, yes, we actually know what we're doing. And
wow.
And like, here's how we use these AI tools. And we've had to fire senior people who forget that they need to actually learn how to, or that they actually need to code, because they pass the coding interviews when we hire them. And maybe like a year later, they're so used to AI coding that they're not qualified anymore.
I never expected that.
Like AI in the hiring and like management tools is wild. Like most of our team is in the Philippines, a great group of people. We've had amazing success there. And a lot of people that we're trying to hire, and I'm sure you've seen this before, you ask them a question and they say, that's a great question. And then you can see their eyes reading the AI prompt of a difficult challenge or like, how would you solve this?
Right.
And so like a lot of like the professional testing centers where you maybe go get a Salesforce or a Shopify certification in person are now offering interview centers where there's a computer that's guaranteed to not have AI tools.
Wow. Yeah. So like that's hiring got a heck of a lot harder. I mean, you look at what's happening at universities, you know, professors and instructors are not getting really any guidance about how to avoid rampant assisting or cheating or like whatever it is.
It's a really fine line because you talk about, yeah, like you're wasting time if you're not using it. But if you turn off that part of your brain, then you're not going to succeed. Like when you talk about hiring, there was someone at your event at NRF who had a quote about, yeah, like the one bit of advice was hire slow, fire fast. And I think that's the thing that, or that we need to get better at.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good lesson for everybody what to do there. Do you think that the time and materials model has a future in the agency world?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Right. I mean, like there are some things that just take time, like time and materials. I think the next few years are going to be interesting. There's a lot of groups that are coming up that are AI first, agency of the future. And I think some of them are going to be very, very successful and others are just not going to have either the discipline or the diversity. I mean, like one thing that I think smaller agencies like us can work on is right now, to be critical, we are plumbers, painters, and architects. We have no philosophers. It's really hard to do what you do, like the strategy work with AI tools. So that requires deep thought. It requires deep experience. And I think as we get more margin pressure, as we get more smaller projects offering services, more like strategy, more other things are going to be what keeps agencies alive.
Yeah, I've seen a few different directions. I've seen definitely agencies move into design, although you wonder with AI, is that even a short-term play? You see them move into like CRO or like email marketing, list growth type of role, something that's recurring and aligns with the business, but it's not necessarily technical.
Right. And so...
Marketing services.
Right. The CEO of a DG that bought my last agency welcomed all employees with a speech. And one of the things that he said that I repeat now is he basically said, the company that you started at today is going to be a different company in 6 months. And it's been a different company every 6 months for the last 20 years. If you're not different in 6 months, you're not going to be here. And so that's true with my company, right? We continue adapting and like we continue to grow because we love this work. So I can't like predict the future, but I know for sure that we're going to grow with what's happening there.
So I think that's a good lesson for the future. I think I just had you referenced the NRF event that I held last Sunday, and
which is the place to be, by the way.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. And one of the things I was recapping 2025, and one of the things we saw, it was a year of fear. It was a year of indecision. Like a lot of clients were sort of like, wait and see, we can delay this org change or this strategy. Let's just optimize our paid media because we know there's some ways there, or can we reduce some layers while we don't go into a big project? You've had a white paper you released recently, your e-commerce planning guide, where you advise clients when to think about a replatform and when to work on other things, which is, I think, isn't like the only question on brands' minds, but it's definitely if you have a platform that's older than 10 years old, which there's a lot of them out there, particularly on a few vendors, it comes up every year. Is this the year we're going to do it, or are we going to push it off another year?
And often because of licensing time, right? Yeah, like, are we ready to commit or get another 3 years to this platform or that other platform? And my and our general philosophy is that replatforms are painful. They're a distraction. Sometimes they're necessary, but you have to really look critically. Am I maximizing the most out of the current platform? We come in to maybe a Salesforce customer and they're looking at going somewhere else. And we do an audit of their systems. And there's hundreds of like screens in the admin panel there. And we can see that they've never touched any of these things. Things that needle for them that are there for free. They don't need another search center. They don't need another thing, and they're just unused. So while the idea of like the new is sexy, like the real hard work is taking what you have and making it better. But I will caveat that with, to your point about like the 10-year-old thing. Like there are some people on really old platforms, maybe a homegrown thing. We're not making the move is so costly for your business, and your customers are leaving. Yeah, like even if your sales are down, like you're losing money faster than you would because of your technology.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I feel like one of the biggest challenges a lot of these brands have is really kind of like a HR or human resource problem. These replatform projects take longer than the average lifespan of a CMO.
Yeah. You know, they're painful. And like, even if you get the world's best deal from the platform, from the agency, whatever, it's a big distraction from your day to day. It's taken away people who should be working on merchandising the site, working on marketing, making it better, faster, stronger. We have a friend who spent years working on this amazing like headless solution on Salesforce, and like lightning fast, spoke to their customers. They had a new CMO come in and say, all right, well, sales are down. This thing isn't working, even though sales had been going down or for years. Mm-hmm. And they said, let's bring in Shopify. And they brought in Shopify, huge distraction after they had just spent years working on the Salesforce thing. And the CMO is gone, and it's in less than a year. So now the team is stuck with, all right, well, what do we do? Do we stay live with our Salesforce thing? Do we finish this Shopify thing? And so that's a case where
they're kind of stuck in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah, where if they had spent that 6 to 9 months in like the time and the cost on really focusing on what's important to their customers, what's important, like maybe optimizing their back end processes, which again are not sexy, but are cost savings.
Yeah.
Now they could have turned things around faster.
Yeah. So, I mean, to follow up on that, it's going to cost you quite a bit for an enterprise contract with any of these platforms. It's going to cost you quite a bit to migrate, redo your integrations, retest them all, ensure that your customers are still having that good experience. Let's call it, you know, a brand is going to save $2 million by not replatforming or like not spend that money all in, like whatever that number is. Like, where should they spend that money instead?
Yeah. And like you talk about that, about like the 2 million, and like even if the licensing fees and the agency fees add up to 2 million, your employee costs,
right?
Like your internal sunk costs is higher. So where should they be spending that? Right. I mean, you know, like we always talk about like nail the basics. Are you maximizing the things that convert the most? Like your search, your checkout, you know, like a lot of what I'm saying is things that guests on your show have been saying, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah, we used to spend months working on the perfect homepage, and the homepage isn't where most of the traffic comes in. It comes into PDPs, and we still have clients. Yeah, when we go through replatforms or designs, spend so much time on the homepage when they should be optimizing their other areas. So
yeah,
I mean, like it's hard, Rick, because you talk about you know, like so many. There's so many places to be distracted from, right? I mean, like a couple of years ago, everyone said, all right, I've got to sell on Instagram. And some brands took off, and others, it was a huge distraction. And then it was, I got to sell on TikTok, and some brands took off. And then most of them, it was just, or like another distraction. And of course, everyone on your show and everyone at the conference is talking about like agentic and other things and like AI tools. And some people are going to be at the forefront and they're going to like cash in, and others, it's just one more thing for a CMO or a VP or director to have to deal with in their day to day.
Yeah. They're going to put it on their resume. They're going to use it to get their next job, but the results at their current company are going to be unmeasurable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and like, don't get me wrong. I mean, like replatforming is part of our business, but we still caution you to make sure that you maximize what you have first.
Right. Yeah. And ultimately, like I read a post about a year or so ago saying most brands would rather gnaw off their own arm than replatform. And I still believe that. I mean, most people, even if they're doing it reluctantly.
Yeah.
And they're dragging their team along with them.
Yeah. And it's just not emotion that teams have, right? Yeah. I mean, like when I was client side and we were looking at replatforming from a homegrown or to another solution, like the board asked me and they said, like, Mark, you've been building this team of people that were ex-agency and that knew the platform really well. Like, yeah, can I assume that you're going to build it yourself? And we're like, no way would I do that. Even though we've all individually done like dozens of these things separately, as a unit, we've done a total of zero.
Right.
It's just too risky. And I think I talked about this like with you at Shop Talk last year.
Yeah. I mean, that's hilarious. So, I mean, I really appreciate the conversation, like the pearls of wisdom that we always get to when we have a drink or a discussion. If there's sort of like one thing that you want people, you know, if they want to learn more about you or how should people find out more?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like we're at the shows, of course, like active on LinkedIn, drop us a follow on LinkedIn. It's not just, like show up to this party or whatever. It's True Thought Leadership. Like we also show that we're giving back. Of course, you can find me on LinkedIn and our site, KasamaDigital.com.
Awesome. Mark, thanks a lot for your time today. Look forward to great to see you at the show and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Great conversation with Mark. I really think the biggest takeaway here is stop chasing the silver bullet. Whether it's assuming AI will fix your business model or assuming a platform migration is going to make you a lot more money, there are things to reconsider here, and it's usually the basics that actually win. Mark mentioned their new white paper, the 2026 e-commerce planning guide. It goes deeper into that don't replatform thesis. I've dropped a link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out. That's all for this week. I'm Rick Watson, and this is the Watson Weekly.